de una parte dentro del pulga infestado vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. ¡It's Batsigando!
Muchas gracias, Jorge. Thank you so much. I will send your madre a check. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, the morning after yet another Grey Goose martini or four, and a slattin' in a taxi who got away. It seems that our young roving correspondent has talked with yet another writer. They seem to be everywhere. They grow on trees. His subject this time is Jonathan Ames, a writer and performer in Brooklyn who has written six books, three of them novels, three of them not-so-novels. His latest novel is Wake Up, Sir, a sentence I am familiar with, too familiar with, every Sunday morning. It's about a writer and his servant named Jeeves, who may or may not be real. The book is very funny. I wouldn't know. You see, 3 years ago, I wagered my sense of humor in a poker game. I had a full house. I was confident. He had a four of a kind. Let's just say he was not so kind in the way that he collected his payment. Anyway, our correspondent thought the book was very funny, and he talked with Mr. Ames, but he had too much coffee in the process.
But I wanted to touch upon a remark that you said in an interview with Robert Birnbaum, mm-hmm. where you said that you place little traces of the environment in your novels. Mm-hmm. And in Wake Up, Sir, I actually saw not just those little traces, but sort of a specific focus upon environmental decay, mm-hmm. which was very interesting. Mm-hmm. You have the burned-out carcass of the Adler Hotel. Mm-hmm. You've got the sort of the rundown town of Sharon Springs, mm-hmm. and you know, the phone book marked up with numbers. Much of your description of the art colony, the lacquered walls and everything, sort mm-hmm. of seemed reminiscent to me of like old England and colonialism as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how much of this was conscious, or was there a it seemed to me that there were more than little traces, that the environments that you depict in this are exceptionally sort of specific. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could touch on that.
Well, I'm not an oppositional person, but I guess when I said messages about the environment, I'm mostly sort of talking about global warming, okay. and pollution and mercury and salmon and all that kind
gotcha.
Of thing. Now, in terms of place and setting,
yes,
like any writer, I'm very conscious and aware of trying to make the settings evocative. And I don't know that thematically, I had Alan Blair and Wake Up, Sir go to an artist colony because I was trying to mimic the structure of a Woodhouse novel in which Bertie Wooster will always end up at a country estate. And for me, the only equivalent was Yaddo, this artist colony. It was
yes.
the closest thing that I could get a character to an estate. I with the Sharon Springs, it was a place I had gone to and had always been very intrigued by. And I think as I wrote in that and the character describes, I'm, like most people, I've always been drawn to ruins, walking through kind of a living past. And so there was the ruins of the bathhouse,
yeah.
this formerly grand hotel, you know, just this idea that you were in a place that once was so much more magnificent. I've always just been romantically drawn to places, as the character writes, that have lost grandeur. But, and then, so that's an environment or setting as a backdrop. But then I also then tried to have the character ruminate on the destruction of trees and how hot it is. And because one of my ongoing things, like most people, is I'm just very upset about what we've done to the physical world and yet feel very powerless to change it. What's happening, and I'm a part of it. I drive a car, I put on an air conditioner, you know what I mean? I'm a weak lemming. But I guess in my own clownish way, I try to at least acknowledge my terror and my broken heart about what's happening to the physical world.
But I also sort of
slipping it in yeah. into characters' ruminations.
But I think also what I was sort of suggesting is that what we see. We see, like, these burned-out sort of carcass of a hotel.
Right.
We see a phone book just, you know, totally decimated
right.
by various
right.
people's phone numbers and things like that. Could these not also be sort of conscious kind of efforts on your part to sort of depict an America that's in decay, you know, a new world versus old world theme, perhaps?
If that's going on, I don't think I was conscious of that. I mean, the phone book in some ways, and you know what? This is like the French interpreters of literature. You know, I'm flattered that you read these things into it because, you know, maybe that's like under my skin all the time, sort of removing me 10% from life all the time is like, we're dying, everything's falling apart, what are we doing, everything's imbalanced, you know.
Yeah.
So that's always broiling under my surface that, like, you know, I was sitting here thinking, like, kind of feeling good about being in San Francisco and you know, and but always underneath it, I'm always waiting for the next sort of cataclysmic event, or I'm very aware of that I think man isn't going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And so that might be an undercurrent if things seem in a state of disrepair in the novel. But that said, the phone book was not a conscious choice. That was more of a plot device.
Yeah.
Okay, I want him to spot some phone numbers. And somehow that whole thing came about, I don't really know, because once a friend of mine, we were in a laundromat, and he's on the wall by the payphone. It was like, for a good time, call Susie. He's like, oh my God, I'm going to do it. You know, we were like 18, and he called, and sure enough, the girl showed up with her brother, the big car chase ensued, and, you know, this whole...
So this was actually based off of a real event?
Yeah, a real event where, like, a friend of mine called one of those numbers, and the girl showed up, and her brother came flying out of the car, and my friend jumped in his van, and then that
guy... Didn't suffer two black eyes.
No, and no fight or anything, And so they went off on a car chase, and I was like hidden in another car in the parking lot waiting to see what would happen. And so then I sort of followed the car that was chasing my friend's car, going, oh my God, and I lost both of them. Then I went back to my friend's house, you know, figure we'll meet there. And so we're in his house. He goes, I think I lost him. Yeah, it was great. And then just then the phone rings, incredible timing. And he picks up the phone real slow, or 18, maybe 17, all nerdy high schoolers. And the guy says to my friend, I know where you live, and hangs up on him. Phone book was just a device to somehow get my guy to call somebody.
I guess it struck me as sort of a kind of ancient symbol because, look, we're in a cell phone culture now.
Right.
People, you know, public phone booths are sort of disappearing.
Right.
If you want a phone number, you call information on your cell phone. No one remembers numbers anymore.
I know, myself included. I mean, I think that novel, I think Wake Up, Sir, is set in 1995. I'm not sure, but I think it's set. So sort of pre-cell phone, pre-internet, or maybe just the beginning of the internet.
Sure.
But yeah, no, it's...
sort of about the time that you were around 30.
I with my novels, I try to time-wise do like an autobiographical parallel.
Yes.
So in like 95, I was spending a lot of time at Yaddo, and so though I'm a much different character than Alan Blair, I didn't have a valet named Jeeves and wasn't living with my aunt and uncle. For me, it helps to have like this sort of timeline parallel. And so in my own way, I'm sort of telling a life history through the novels and the essays.
Well, this also, I read that this actually was originally intended as a sequel to The Last Man.
The Extra Man.
Oh, The Extra Man, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. It was originally a sequel to The Extra Man. It was sort of taking the young gentleman themes that I was really pushing in The Extra Man to the next level, where... And then the character had left the old man he was living with and now was trying to write a novel about it. But then I realized I could stand on it. I didn't want to weaken that book or try to live up to that book or, you know, that it was going to hold me back to have to, you know, hearken up too many of the things set up there. But in some ways, it's very much a sequel because Alan Blair is writing a novel called The Walker,
yes,
which is a phrase that can be interchanged with The Extra Man. A walker and an extra man are the same thing in upper-class New York society. And he's the same age as that Lewis Ives would be.
Yes.
And actually, two of the passages from The Walker and Wake Up, Sir, I'm remembering my own book now, were passages that for some reason I didn't include in the extra man, but I found them in my notes. I'm like, hey, these are pretty good. You know, and you're always trying to fill pages. I'm like, well, I'll put these in. One's influenced by the people that read one's work. So if I got emails or people coming up to me telling me how much they like the extra man, I was like, well, I want to give them a little bit of the extra man. And so here's like almost like two outtakes, you know, and they get to see that those characters again. And those like they're only like page and a half excerpts or something.
In the old world, and Jeeves is from the old world because he's English.
Right.
We had a situation where, you know, servants mm-hmm. knew inherently their place.
Right.
And, you know, there was a very sort of, you know, specific class system. Whereas in the New World, in America, it's more sort of an egalitarian, sort of democratic sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in light of this mentality, was any of this sort of weighing on your mind during the devising or the writing of Wake Up, Sir? Class distinctions and status and, you know, also the sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm. Adorable baby right behind your shoulder. So, it's very distracting in a pleasant way. So, God, I'm feeling, you know, feeling so banal. Because like, also it's trying to remember what one was doing. But when I have Alan trying to find out what Jeeves is up to or his life, there's in the Woodhouse books one of the running themes is that Jeeves belongs to a society of butlers or valets.
Yes.
And that these butlers and valets keep a diary of what goes on, and it's actually, I think it's called the Ganymede Club. And so I couldn't quite draw on that because I had to be very careful not to use anything directly from Woodhouse for legal reasons.
Yeah.
But I think I was intrigued by the notion of, in the Woodhouse books, Bertie Wooster's always worried about what Jeeves has possibly written in those diary entries and that he wants to get a hold of them because they could be used against him. But other than that, I guess I wasn't thinking too much about class in my book because Alan, it's sort of like an extra man, he's from Jewish middle-class origins, but he has sort of fantasies of the English life and being a gentleman, whatever that might mean. But he really is not of the upper class in any way. And in fact, I guess the excerpt from The Extra Man, or The Walker, which is in Wake Up, Sir, he wishes he could be alive in the 20s so he could go to the Yale Club.
Yes.
But then he realizes he couldn't go to the Yale Club in the 20s because he's Jewish. So the Henry Harrison character says, well, I imagine if you could time travel, you could change your religion.
Yeah.
You know, you know, you would have great powers. But he's like, well, I wouldn't want to change my religion. But somewhere in there is a slight fantasy. What would it be like to be of the upper class? And I don't have it so much. And I'm not sure that I ever did. But at one time, I really loved English novels. And in fact, I'm reading Somerset Maugham again. And there was something But Somerset Maugham, at least the stories I'm reading right now, is always about these foreign civil servants in far-off lands.
Tropical, very big time.
But the maintenance of some sort of class structure where you have a boy that brings you your meal. And there's this very regimented life. You know, you have breakfast, and then they make you lunch, and then you have a late afternoon cocktail, and you dress for dinner. And
Are you reading the short stories or like the really sort of like the 30-pager stories? There's I'd have the complete short stories of Mom, and there's like two books, and they're divided into like shorts and like, you know, almost novella length stories. Right. And the novella length stories, for the most part, take place in the tropical isles.
Right.
I find that to be interesting.
Yeah, I have like some paperback which seems to be a mix of those.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There's a couple of like 30 pagers and then a couple of 4 pagers.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting mix. So again, where these roundabout answers. But no, I don't think I was thinking too much about class distinction or old world. I guess mostly my themes usually are love and loneliness and eros and how love and loneliness get mixed up with eros, you know, maybe art and writing, and adventure. I think those are my themes. I'm not sure that I was thinking about old world, new world kind of stuff.
Or like the world before, like, you know. Like,
yeah, maybe a hankering for the world before, yeah, the romance of the world before, and romance for simpler, seemingly more elegant times.
Because one thing you've done with this that I first of all, I think that the servant in literature is always a really interesting character. Mm-hmm. It's been the basis for, like, you know, Sancho Panza. It's been Falstaff and Hal.
Right.
It's been one of those sort of things where the servant can actually have, and particularly in Jeeves's case, the servant sort of has the upper hand at all times. But it's not something that we can actually necessarily see in contemporary literature because we no longer live in a society that has, you know, servants. We have, the service sector is now sort of shifted so that you, if you do have that, you actually go somewhere else for that. And so I guess there is a certain kind of romantic feel I felt, obviously. But at the same time, there's also the sort of the absurdity of like, you know, some, you know, writer who's trying to finish a novel having a servant by the basis of a $250,000 windfall, or either that or his own imagination, we don't know.
Right.
But I guess I'm not necessarily certain it's just class, but it's also sort of it's all where am I going with this?
Well, no, but I think you were touching on something, because by bringing up Sancho Panza,
yes,
and I was aware. See, like, sometimes, you know, I took literature classes in college, and so sometimes I'm aware of these old tropes that we heard about,
yes,
appearance versus reality. So I was kind of playing with that. It's like, in my own sort of postmodern way, well, Jeeves seems like a real character. He has lines of dialogue,
but we
just
never
like
see
a
him
real
anywhere.
Character.
Yeah.
Why? What makes him any less real than any of the other characters, or certainly the way he's presented on the page? Mm-hmm. How can you tell the difference? So it had a lot almost to do with just the way a character appears on the page. I was also aware somewhat, again, just of the phrase, the master-slave relationship. And I remember that from college. So at some point, I think Alan says, in our master-servant relationship, like in terms of them sharing a motel room or something.
Yes.
I think he says something like, I didn't know if it was improper in our master-servant relationship. So again, I was sort of playing with the fact of, like, this was a classic buddy bizarro setup that goes back in literature. Like,
yeah.
I think even Shakespeare with the king and the fool, or Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, you know. But, yeah, and whereas the master is actually the slave, and the slave is the master in a way.
Yes.
So that's a little less evident in my book, though. Alan really needs Jeeves, you know. And somebody wrote me a really nice email. I'm not sure who. Some fan who read the book, but they, in their mind, and I'm not going to reveal what my intention was for whatever silly reason, not that anybody cares, but in their mind, they realized that Jeeves was not real once they got a certain way into the book. But this gave them hope for Alan, mm-hmm, because the fact that he had Jeeves inside him, that even if he had that voice, you know, that was hopeful, you know, that there was a voice of reason and counsel and patience and tolerance inside him. I think at one point I wrote a screenplay version where they have a bit of a fight. I don't know if it's in the novel.
Oh.
I've gotten the two mixed up in my head. Well, I like that she said that. And so it's interesting, master, servant, ego, id, superego.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? These are
Well, there's a Freudian sort of thing, perhaps, that one can sort of detect from the pages.
Yeah, like ego, superego, though.
Yeah.
I sometimes understand those terms, and then I lose them again. You know what I mean? It's weird. All right, wait, which is the superego, and which is the ego? And
well, okay, and this may be deconstructing it too much, but Alan Blair's initials, AB, you know, the first two letters of the alphabet. So, yeah. I mean, you know, it could be interpreted that way if that represents sort of like the beginning of Alan, perhaps. If one wanted to go there.
Well, there's more of a hint as to the origins of his name in the book's dedication. If you look at the opening dedication, it's dedicated to Blair Clark and Alan Cholis in memoriam. So I dedicate to two friends of mine who died.
Gotcha.
And I took their two first names. But in the dedication, so it wouldn't be too obvious, I said to Blair Clark and Alan Cholis.
Oh,
okay. So Blair Clark, Alan Cholis. So you see Blair, Alan.
Yeah.
And then you reverse it. It's Alan Blair. So,
okay.
And that's why I had the two of them sort of looking over me as I wrote the book.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I wanted to actually discuss something.
Speaking of dedications, though, one other little just hidden things.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book under a pseudonym, Spencer Johns. It was some hack work I did, a novelization of a screenplay, 200 Cigarettes.
Really?
I did a novel based on the screenplay. I didn't see the movie. The movie hadn't come out yet. This was this was like 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So I turned this screenplay into a book, 200 Cigarettes. Turned out to be exactly 200 pages, which was interesting, in manuscript form. Then published as a book, it was 200 pages. But I dedicated it to J.A. So that was kind of my own little thing. And then the epigraph was the Surgeon General's warning. So that's my little game I played at the front of that book.
That's the other, actually, Wake Up, Sir has 39 chapters,
mm-hmm.
which harkened to me like 39 steps, because there's the conversation where they're talking about, like, Alan is saying he can't get up the stairways. It's like early in the book, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know. Part of me sort of thought that the 39 chapters represented perhaps 39 steps.
What 39 steps are you thinking of?
Well, 39 steps, he is on the lam, both at the, near the beginning and near the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be the classical sort of 39 steps, both the movie and the John Buchanan book.
Oh, okay, yeah, I didn't know the allusion, so I don't know the movie 39 Steps.
Oh, really? It's a Hitchcock movie. It's an early Hitchcock. It's one of the ones that really made his name, but it's also a very good spy novel by John Buchanan. It's either John Buchan or John Buchanan. I think it's John Buchanan. 1939, I believe, was when it came out, but yeah.
Well, I think with the numbering of the chapters, I had never done numbered chapters before, and I think I sometimes really liked it when authors would do numbered chapters because they'd be building. And I think Bukowski did a few books with numbered chapters. I do think I may have edited it and then manipulated it towards the end, the final edit, because I finished the book when I was 39.
Oh,
so
okay.
Again, that was my own little personal.
So when we read a Jonathan Ames novel, now or in the future, we should look out for these little things? Or?
I think those are just things you stumble upon by chance that have meaning to you and to no one else, you know? But one could argue, I think, interestingly enough, but maybe people get bored of these two, but both Hemingway and Kerouac seem to imply that truths underneath the writing would reach the reader. Hemingway in some description of capturing action, and then Kerouac in some description of the spontaneous prose. Both of them spoke of like things underneath the writing getting to the reader. So I'm not saying these little things like to Blair Clark and Alan Jolis or 39 chapters for 39 years of my life. But maybe they do resonate, you know? It's almost in a Kabbalistic way, or, you know, the magic of numbers. But in my book, so I definitely, there are little things that readers wouldn't get. I think every writer does that.
Yeah.
Somebody actually spotted something I couldn't believe, but I think I named the director of Wake Up, Sir, last name Hibben.
Yeah.
I didn't quite remember, but I think I got the Hibben from like some president of Princeton, or there was Hibben Garden Princeton, and I just always had liked that name. And so then some fan somehow read my book and then was reading something about Princeton and saw that there was a President Hibben and was like, is that where you got the name? And
there was a President Hibben when you were at Princeton.
No, I don't think so, but there was a garden or a Hibben bench I used to go to or something like that. Hibben,
wow.
H-I-B-B-E-N. And, so every writer, I think, plants little things that have meaning to them that other people might not get.
In your case, this was purely sort of subconscious kind of
the
name Hibben? Yeah.
I'm not subconscious conscious. It was I like the name. It seemed to have like kind of an old-fashioned ring to it.
Yeah.
I do think I gave him the first name Roderick, but I'm not sure I did. But I think I did, which was the name of Bertie Wooster's nemesis.
Yes.
Roderick Glossop. It was like a shrink that's, you know, always after him.
But, okay. Oh, I was going to ask you, how much of your Princeton background mm-hmm. is in your writing today? How much is there?
Well, my Princeton background. Well, the thing is, I was not a very good scholar. I feel college is wasted on a lot of people. I mean, if I'd gone to college at 24, let's say, I would have gotten so much more out of it. At 18, I just wanted to drink beer and impress girls, and, you know, and so I couldn't really access the resources of Princeton. So in some ways, but then again, I read my journals from back then, and I was being exposed to philosophy and literature, and that stuff was, like, definitely playing in my mind, and I got to study with Joyce Carol Oates. So, I mean, I think I was surrounded by really intelligent, interesting people. Living in the town afterwards and driving a cab and then reading the literature I did at the time, that also influenced me. So I don't know what, if there was specific something to being at Princeton that influenced me other than that.
At this point, our correspondent's tools befuddled him. His recorder copped out, and he missed several pivotal moments. Not the mark of a professional. You see, the information that transpired was this. While Mr. Ames was at Princeton, Joyce Carol Oates, reading Ames's work, recommended Last Exit at Brooklyn, or Last Exit to Brooklyn. I don't know. And we don't know if Miss Oates actually wrote a short story or maybe a poem while she was actually handing Mr. Ames this book. But we have every reason to believe that she did do this, which is more than I could say or do in a 6-month period. Anyway, back to the interview.
Okay, so somehow the mini disc recorder had accidentally sort of dropped off, so we're back in action here. Mm-hmm. We were talking, I guess, about your serious side that you can't sustain. Mm-hmm. You can't find yourself sustaining in a novel. I guess you want to jump off from there.
Well, I don't know.
I mean,
the word serious, but I mean, it seems like eventually I will laugh about something or something humorous in life. I can't, like I said, the tragic comic. I mean,
yes.
You don't get more depressing than Beckett, but he's also funny. So,
yes.
But that doesn't mean he's not serious. So the question was more like, can I not be comedic in some way? And I don't think I can be, at least not in a novel. And in a singular essay, I think I can maintain a more somber, quiet tone. But for me, things always do come back around to being humorous. I was also sort of staying just because we had touched upon the Princeton influence.
Yes.
And just looking at my own work and even this current essay collection, I would say that a lot of my essays, I've tossed them off and written them quickly. And it doesn't mean that they can't be amusing or have value, but mm-hmm. with the novels, I tried much harder to polish them, and they're more crafted and solid in a sense. And yet there are people that much prefer the essays to the novels that read my work. And so and some people like both. But it's interesting, though, because in thinking about my own self, as I said to you, I don't have it recorded. There's this mix of the highbrow and the lowbrow.
Yes.
And maybe not that highbrow, more like lowbrow and middlebrow. What was that beer? Lowenbrow or middlebrow. But and also sitting here, and I'm really honored by the depth of your questions and how serious some of your readings into some of what I've done is. And
well,
and then I wonder, though, I don't know, how am I perceived as a writer? You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing of like, I'm unable to see myself just because of the nature of things. Like, I can't quite spin around. Like, I know, for example, how Jonathan Franzen is perceived, or
yeah.
Walter Kern, or I'm just choosing hats out of the you know, Ethan Kanan, whose name I haven't heard of lately, or Jonathan Lethem, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm perceived exactly. I mean, it's a bit of a narcissistic question, perhaps, but how am I perceived, do you think? Am I, like, where am I in the whole world of contemporary letters? I mean, I seem to be in the mix, I think.
Well,
I mean, you can lay it out. You can say, well, look, everyone thinks you're kind of funny,
well,
but, you know.
I laugh myself silly with Wake Up, Sir, and I laugh myself silly over your essays. Mm-hmm. But I also, I think, was drawn, okay, to get to your essays, I was drawn to the sort of very sort of honest and kind of honest approach that you committed to those press things about, like, you know, about smoking crack, you know, on Christmas, or about talking about your hair, or talking about, you know, genital warts, whatever.
What?
Exactly. With this book, Wake Up, Sir, I actually, believe it or not, I read it mostly in one sitting. Mm-hmm. And I was really sort of, I was fascinated by the question of whether Jeeves was or was not real. He was very sort of, you know, you didn't see him around other people. Mm-hmm. I felt that there was a distinct sort of literary sensibility in there, running hand in hand with, you know, hey, I'm Jonathan Ames, I'm a funny man, which I don't mind. I prefer, I like to laugh at a book as well, but I also, I felt that, it is a good question. I mean, I think your book, your work is definitely literary in some scope, but the problem is, and this has been the kind of recurring sort of problem that comedy has, is that comedy, the efforts and the sort of the major efforts you make in order to actually go ahead and craft something, in order to sort of mold something into a narrative, are genuinely not nearly as respective enough as some sort of really sort of serious kind of weighty book. As you know, I mean, and that's sort of a problem, I guess, that you may be facing. Your very inability to sort of characterize your literature, your books, within the sort of realm of literature. Do you think that might be reflective of, you know, the kind of underappreciated nature of the comic novel, or?
Well, wait, what was it? My inability to what?
I guess
one word you missed.
Your inability to pinpoint exactly, and mine too, it looks like, to pinpoint exactly where you were placed within the sort of realm of literature. Yeah. You think that has something to do with how the comic novel is sort of, and particularly satire, which this is colossally misunderstood in this country. Do you think that has something to do with how underappreciated the comic novel is? Or?
Because people seem obviously to love to laugh, but maybe that does keep something from being taken very more seriously. Because I did try to put in larger questions of identity and alcoholism and loneliness and
fetishism, nose fetishes.
Yeah, nose fetishism and, you know, and religion and, you know, all sorts of things in there. But maybe in some ways it gets dismissed, or people who are looking for serious literature won't pick it up. Or I felt with my novel, The Extra Man, which, I mean, I worked a long time on that book. And
it was banned in Turkey, I might add. So
was that one banned in Turkey?
Yes, it was. And I was going
to
ask.
Oh yeah, it was banned in Turkey. I think more as a reaction to I Pass Like Night, and then the publisher had put out a book about the Armenians.
So. I just wondered if you were like the literary equivalent of Billy Hayes or something.
I don't know what's happened to me in Turkey. I used to get these beautiful emails from my Turkish translator, and they were such champions of me. But then I haven't heard anything from him. I did write an essay where I, you know, he once wrote to me, "You don't get the recognition you don't deserve," or something like that. He like mangled his English a little in an email, and I quoted that in one of my columns just because it was sort of funny.
Yeah.
Maybe he read that column somehow and has never written me again. I hope not. But anyway, but that book, like, I felt, you know, was kind of a lot there, but maybe because it was funny, it didn't quite get the attention that it might have gotten otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm not very smart, or don't have pithy summary phrases about literature, the comic novel, and I'm just sort of curious, but it's more just, again, a narcissistic question. It's like, how I'm perceived exactly, like, because I'm going to be coming out with my sixth book, and that's like a fair number of books, you know, and I mean, I'd like to, I mean, I'm certainly not going to be an Updike or Joyce Carol Oates, so it'd be kind of cool to be a writer like that, where you have 80 books. My God, can you imagine having written 80, 90, 100 books, have that much to say, to be able to craft that many sentences?
But you are also doing television and film projects. I wanted to kind of touch on that a little bit, you know.
Yeah, and I perform a lot, and I teach, and I live life. You know, there's only so much you can do. Plus, I procrastinate like hell, and, you know, I'm very bad and stuff, so... So that takes up a lot of time. But anyway, I just don't know. But some people seem to enjoy my books, and I'm glad for that. So
I was going to ask, though, specifically, like, what happened to the Showtime adaptation of What's Not to Love?
Well, what happened is I wrote a script. Amazingly, we filmed it. I got to play myself. It was a hell of a lot of fun. It was really one of the funnest weeks of my life. Acting in that thing, hamming it up, learning how to act on the fly, getting better, having a crew and catering trucks, and it was neat. And then I was looking pretty good, but then at the last moment, they decided not to go to series. They went with a series based on the movie Barbershop. It seemed like a typical Hollywood punchline. Yeah, they didn't go with the thing.
So they were almost ready to commit to this.
They were almost
ready
to do it. They were going to do 5 or 6 episodes. They had figured out the budget for that many episodes. But then they went with this thing based on Barbershop. So it was very disappointing, actually, because it was like, whoa, this could be a lot of fun. I could make a lot of money. It combines the two things I do, which is to perform and write. And it just seemed like I just was going to get better at it and write outrageous things. And the pilot's pretty outrageous. There's a character based on my friend, the Mangina. I have this wild, chaotic scene in an art gallery.
I was going to ask you if the Mangina showed up.
Yeah, oh, it was great. And so I think they're going to broadcast it at some point. I just don't know when.
Well, however, though, let's say in a parallel universe, in the bizarre universe, that did actually get greenlit. Green-lighted. What would happen then to the Jonathan Ames I just heard, who is sort of trying to find himself and wants to put these nonfiction sort of episodes to bed?
Yeah, no, I know. Maybe
these things happen for a reason. I
know. So then I'll hopefully have the time to write a really great novel or something that's really fulfilling to try to produce. My future was on hold, you know what I mean? Because it was like, my future was I was going to be kind of a unknown TV star, because not that many people watch Showtime. But, you know, I still would have had my own, you know. But so now I'm sort of back to being me again.
Yes.
But I'm not quite sure who I am, and I'm 41, and I'm going through some sort of molting emotionally and career-wise. And I'm not really sure who I am. But I hope I have another good novel in me. I got to find my voice again. I always draw my inspiration from other writers, and I need to find the writer that I want to really sets me up. Like Woodhouse set me up for Wake Up, Sir, and Bukowski set me up for my columns. And
well, you also, I had heard that there was talk of a Chandler-inspired...
Because... Like, there's been a number of writers who I just love to death over the years. Bukowski, Woodhouse, Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, Paul Auster. Right? These are the writers that I've read maybe 8 or 9 of their books, and I just seem to gobble them up. I think it's... I either love the prose or the stories, and so Chandler's certainly one that I've returned to a lot, and I've read all his books at least twice, so it'd be fun to try to recreate that voice. But that's also, unlike the Woodhouse in a way, that's something a lot of writers have tried to do, so it feels a little
Then again, the Coen brothers, their biggest sort of cult hit is by taking the Raymond Chandler formula and turning it into the Big Lebowski. So
I watched that recently.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you said that. And I'm like, wait, this is basically
Big Sleep.
Yeah, this is like...
And that's the thing. It actually stands, though, as its own sort of separate entity, you know. Mm-hmm. And also Altman's film The Long Goodbye, or, you know, any of the sort of Chandler books that, you know, people have been inspired by.
Yeah.
But speaking of inspired authors, I know we have to get going here, but one final question or series of final questions. I wanted to talk about Anthony Powell.
Mm-hmm. Or some people say Anthony Pohl.
Pohl?
That's how they, that's how the snobs.
Okay. Well,
I pronounce it.
Like Frederick
Just
Pohl.
So you know, you could, because supposedly, if you read things on the internet about him, you'll often see pronounced Pohl.
Really? I had no idea.
Yeah.
So not Frederick's brother, though.
What? Not who?
Frederick Pohl, the science fiction writer?
I don't know him.
Oh, okay.
But.
Well, anyway, Anthony Pohl.
Right.
That's interesting. That makes sense. You also reference him very repeatedly in Wake Up, Sir.
Well, I was reading that during the writing of it, yeah.
But we were talking also about how Wake Up, Sir was almost a sequel to the Extra Man.
Right.
And I wanted to sort of touch upon this because Paul's work is all about this mammoth sort of interconnected
12,
series of novels.
A Dance
12 of them.
Of the Music of Time.
Yes.
And then
which are
the four seasons, you know, and they I think it begins in spring because it begins in his youth.
Yeah.
Then summer, fall, winter.
Yes.
And then each season is composed of four books. It's very musical. And,
yes.
And A Dance of the Music of Time was the name of a piece of music as well as a famous painting. But
yes. But the point of this I was trying to make is that there was a distinct, you know, this man set about doing this interconnectedness with his with his work.
Right.
And I'm wondering if by sort of not tying Wake Up, Sir into The Extra Man, is it sort of a hesitation to interconnect your work, or have you been consciously thinking about like a series of books perhaps that are interconnected? Has this occurred to you, or I mean, is it a subject you've been debating as you sort of devise your novels?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I resisted like creating a huge interconnection thing, only because when I decided that it wasn't a sequel, I felt like it was hamstringing me and I was going to have to pay too much respect to The Extra Man.
Yeah.
I also don't know that I have a vision. Basically, what Pohl did was write these autobiographical novels over the course of like 40 years.
Yeah.
Basically, from the 40s... No, let's see. He began it...
I think 1930s?
He may have begun it in the late 30s. No, I think he began it after World War II.
Yeah.
He began it after World War II. But the story itself begins in like
before,
in like just after the First World War.
Yeah.
And then captures basically London literary life from like 1918 to like 1972, basically.
Yes.
From like just after the First World War to the hippies. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
A lot of it very boring, but somehow engrossing at the same time. I think at one point, I'm sober at this time for a couple of years now, but a couple of years ago I got stoned and I had a vision of my work, of the interconnection of it all. and I have it written down in a journal.
Oh, no.
And I actually had a vision of the novels I want to write. I should find that because maybe those will be the novels I write. But
yeah,
there was this thing, I don't know if it came to me in that stone moment or several moments, but then I, in my own way, like Kerouac had Vanity of Douloirs.
Yeah.
His whole works, but like I Pass Like Night basically captures my late teens and 20s and childhood memories.
Yes.
The Extra Man captures my 20s. The essays basically cover a lot of childhood, but then my life in New York, like early 30s. Wake Up, Sir captures like early mid 30s. What I haven't captured is now like late 30s, early 40s. So now some of the essays have been touching on that. But so on one hand, there was the idea of the novels always lining up timeline-wise with some of the issues I was going through at the period. But in that stone vision, there was a thing of like, The Extra Man was like the young gentleman phase. Wake Up, Sir was Woodhouse. Mm-hmm. There was going to be all this you know, the next novel was going to be Chandler. I forget all the visions I had.
This is actually very much like Alan Blair's constant sort of novel titles that he's tossing out through the book. The homosexuals are coming. And
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. At one time in college, a friend and I sat down and wrote down on like a paper placemat in some diner the titles of our book someday. But we were purposely coming up with bad titles. And the one that was like the worst but the best and or something was Segway Harbor. Like, I don't know.
Well, it's not unheard of. I mean, Richard Yates, towards the end of his life, had like a list, and it's in Blake Bailey's biography.
Uh-huh.
But basically, he had a list of something like either 10 or 20 titles of books that he wanted to write, and he realized that he would only get a chance to write like three or four.
So it's not unheard of,
to have like titles or, you know.
Right. So I don't know that I have a grand vision like Anthony Pohl did. I don't think I do. But he's, you know, because I would, well, in his case, he dedicated, you know, 40 years of his writing. I don't know that he wrote any other novels during the times that he was writing A Dance to the Music of Time. I mean, he wrote novels before that period.
Yes.
But I don't know, and I'm not a Pohl expert, if he wrote anything other than A Dance to the Music of Time once he started it. I'm not sure.
Gotcha.
So
I guess I'm not necessarily completely suggesting that you have some sort of grand overarching 40-year vision.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I was sort of asking is tying in, like, say, The Extra Man with, you know, another novel down the road, mm-hmm. or revisiting, do you feel sort of reluctant to revisit characters, or...?
Well, somewhat, because, like, I mean, that's why I ended up not making Wake Up, Sir a sequel, because I was like, well, then I got to bring Henry back, and I don't know if I can bring him back as good as I once had him. You know, I was afraid of falling short and disappointing people.
Yes.
You know, like Anthony Burgess did those Enderby books.
Yes.
And it definitely seemed by the end he was losing steam or something.
Well, he was turning him out left and right.
And by the end it was like Enderby wasn't nearly as enjoyable as he'd been at the beginning, I felt. And I didn't want to do that to something that had been sort of worked so nicely in the case of The Extra Man. And like one reviewer was like, I hope we'll have more of these Jeeves books from Ames, you know? And
yeah.
But again, it's like, I don't know that I'm interested anymore in doing that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not. But obviously, when you do come up with one of these things, you know, it can be like a great moneymaker when you have the private detective you can keep churning out, you know? But I feel like I'll probably have to jump around more. Though I kind of thought maybe a sequel to Wake Up, Sir would be Alan Blair. Maybe he sobers up and gets a little more sane, and then he reads a lot of Chandler, and he suddenly, you know...
Philip Marlowe.
He, like, hires a detective named Marlowe or something. That would be bizarre. But that might seem a little bit too much of a trick. But I could almost see where Alan Blair... Oh, I know what I think the stoner vision was. It was always like characters who were deeply influenced by books. But it's not unlike what Jonathan Lethem has certainly been doing, you know, with all his, you know, homages, whether to the detective novel or comics or whatever he does.
Well, two of his books are very, very deeply steeped in
the
in
detective.
Chandler.
Yeah. So, but, I gotta find the next thing that's really interesting to me. Because when you write a novel, you got to stick with it a couple of years and got to really be hooked by an idea. It's almost like you have to hook an idea, but you also have to be hooked. You know what I mean? I'm thinking of fishing. You really got that hook's got to be deep in your mouth to keep you going for two or three years, you know?
Gotcha.
So.
Well, I know you have to go, so it was...
Probably, but if you have one more question or something...
Let's see here. I wanted to actually talk about, really quickly, the sartorial parallels between you and your characters.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a whole bunch of seersucker jackets at home? Or?
I have one seersucker jacket. I think all the sport coats that Alan Blair talks about in Wake Up, Sir, I do own. I went through... In my 20s, captured in the novel The Extra Man, a real, what I call the young gentleman phase, where I was really into sport coats and presenting myself in a certain way. I happen to like sport coats because I feel like it's basically a male purse. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm able to carry a wallet, keys, a little notepad, often a paperback novel, while wearing a sport coat. So The Extra Man was a whole exploration of this whole young gentleman thing I used to go through. And then Wake Up, Sir was a continuation of that. But in my 30s at some point, I must have become less self-conscious or less caring about my appearance. And so I became less aware about what I was wearing somehow.
Gotcha.
And now I just kind of wear clothes for function. Doesn't mean I'm trying to look sloppy, but
yeah.
I mean, I'm wearing a sport coat now. And I always wear one when I travel because, yeah. You know, carry passport and all that.
But you're not nowhere nearly sort of the obsessive white suit Tom Wolfe kind of thing going
no,
on.
No, not at all. But I like wearing my seersucker jacket. Though being bald and somewhat blonde complected with seersucker, you do tend to just disappear. You know, like you're kind of like a white stripe.
Yeah.
You know, you're not really there. So.
Are you still concerned about your baldness? Or?
Not concerned. No, I basically set myself. I mean, when I see photos, I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know.
But you know,
everyone
what?
Feels they look better with hair, and it would be fun to comb my hair and brush my hair, but I miss doing that. But I haven't done it for years now, so.
But Jonathan, I have to tell you that seeing you and balding myself, I know that there is another side. So you know, I know that there is a point that you can. Seeing you, I can see that there is a point to get through. You actually end up getting through it. So.
Yeah, no, I'm through it. I'm not upset about it. Women have been great to me. I've not lacked for attention from women because of my hair. So, that said, I still be fun to like have a comb and a brush and you know you can be able to grease something back. You know, just I don't know, just fool around with it and like try to look cool. I don't know.
Well, you could always get like a temporary, you know, either a wig or something.
And no, like... I don't want a wig. But so. No, I'm over, and I wear this hat a lot because, you know, when you don't have hair, your head can be very cold.
Yeah, I know.
And people think, like, I'm just covering my baldness, but I'm like, you know what, actually, my head gets cold.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely. Yeah. Well, Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.
It was a pleasure.
Likewise.